From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik.
Today on Transition Lab, we have a guest host. I'm Yamiche Alcindor, the White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. The Partnership for Public Service asked me to host this last podcast on the 2020 transition. Going forward, the podcast will continue with a different focus. Stay tuned for more on that. The 2020 transition was like no other in history. On Transition Lab in May, the eminent historian and my PBS colleague, Ken Burns, said this.
Let us step back a little bit and celebrate that since 1797, when George Washington gave up the presidency after two terms and John Adams took over, we have had an unbroken succession of presidential administrations. No troop has been alerted. Nobody's fought and said no.
This year, of course, that unbroken streak was broken. Troops were alerted. Five Americans died. A president sought to overturn the will of the people. And all of this occurred amid a global pandemic, a deep recession, and a racial reckoning in our country. It was also the first virtual transition in the history of the United States. Today on this podcast, we are going to hear the full story of the 2020 transition by David Marchik, the director of the Center for Presidential Transition and the host of Transition Lab. David, thanks for joining, and thank you for asking me to guest host. So I want to first ask you, when did the center start work on the 2020 transition, and why does the Partnership for Public Service dedicate resources to transitions?
Well, thanks for hosting this, and thanks for being here, Yamiche. I'm a huge fan of yours, as you know, and I think you're just incredible, and so it's an honor for me to be with you tonight. So the center started working on transitions in 2008 when Max Steyer, the head of the Partnership for Public Service, said, "We're focused on effectiveness in government, and an effective government starts with an effective transition." So the partnership has been working on transitions for four cycles. In this cycle, a small team of people, Shannon Carroll, Dan Hyman, and Chantal Wren, literally started working on the 2020 transition right after the 2016 transition, which was not a smooth transition, as you recall. So I joined in October of 2019, and one of the first things we did was we had an all-day meeting with Rich Bagger and Ed Meyer, who were the heads of the respective transitions for Trump and Clinton. And we basically sat all day in a room and went through month by month, day by day, subject by subject, and talked about what went well, what didn't go well, and how could the Partnership for Public Service help in the 2020 cycle? And so we've been working on this for a long time.
It has been a long time. And it also feels like the transition was a long time. When did you start engaging the Democratic candidates? Of course, at one point there were dozens of them. Were they interested in discussing the transition early in 2020, or was it just too early? Tell me a little bit about how that worked.
So we started reaching out in January of 2020. We talked to probably 8 to 10. Most of them were actually interested, in particular, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and of course, Joe Biden. His team was very interested. And our basic message in January was, if you're still standing in March, that's when you need to start. The transition is a huge, huge undertaking, and you need to start early. We've learned from history that if you start late or you fall behind, you can't catch up. And then the Biden team, of course, they really got going in March when Ted Kaufman, Mark Gitenstein, and a few others launched the Biden transition. And then soon thereafter, they added more people, including Jeff Zients and Johannes Abraham.
I also want to ask you, the partnership is nonpartisan. When did you start talking to the Trump White House? Were they cooperative, interested in engaging on transition issues? And who were their key players? It sounded like you had on the Democratic side a lot of people who were really interested in engaging with you. What about on the Republican side and our former president, President Trump?
Well, we started working with the Trump White House. We're, of course, nonpartisan in January as well. Actually, it started when Josh Bolton, the former Bush chief of staff and a member of our advisory committee and a very good friend and mentor, he set up a meeting with Chris Liddell, who is the deputy chief of staff, Josh and me. We had breakfast at the White House mess. And Chris, of course, was responsible for both second term planning, should Trump have won, but also responsible for planning a Trump exit. And, you know, obviously when you're in the White House and you're talking to a White House official and you say, actually, Josh asked him near the end of the breakfast, he said, well, what are you doing? What are your plans in case Trump loses? How can you usher in a smooth transition? And there was kind of an awkward silence. Maybe we looked down at our empty egg breakfast. But Chris was very good. That launched the process. And then we worked closely with Chris and his team throughout the year. And, you know, we did a podcast last week with Chris, and I called it The Good, The Bad, The Ugly. So prior to the election, actually, the transition planning effort in the White House was very effective because it was kept under the radar screen and Trump wasn't focused on it. After the election, obviously, you had the delayed ascertainment. That was the bad. And then the ugly was really January 6th and beyond. So Chris did a good job. He did a couple of things that were unique. He really embraced the career staff because he knew that doing anything else would be controversial. And so by embracing the career staff across the government, including at GSA, you're basically saying this is a nonpartisan exercise consistent with the law. And second is he took a lot of the template that Obama used on his exit in 2016 and said, we're going to do the same thing. Then we also worked closely with the General Services Administration. Again, they did a really good job up to the election. You had this very, very bad pause during ascertainment. And then once again, things got going.
The administration was required to implement this law called the Presidential Transition Act. You're talking a bit about kind of your interactions with the Trump White House. Did they follow the law? And what were the requirements of the law? I think so many Americans learned about this during this kind of chaotic transition. Tell us a little bit more about how this is supposed to work and how it actually did work.
So the law was passed in 1963 after the 1960 election, which was very close. Unlike this year where we had a 7 million vote delta. In 1960, Kennedy beat Nixon by 118,000 votes nationwide. And so Congress passed a law that required the outgoing administration to cooperate, to plan, to coordinate with the challenger, to prepare briefing materials, and to meet representatives of the president-elect to help them onboard. You know, I'd say that the career staff across the government did a really good job. The political staff, it was very, very uneven. At some agencies, they were very cooperative. They wanted to help. They wanted to do what was good for the country. At some agencies, they were totally uncooperative and did either nothing or did the minimum. So it was very, very uneven at the political level.
You're saying that it was very uneven. Part of that also was, of course, that you started working with the Biden team in early spring. There were early decisions that they made, and I'm wondering, how did they affect the shape of the transition, and how did those early talks and that unevenness of it all end up playing out overall?
So the Biden team was staffed with very, very experienced hands. Ted Kaufman, of course, was the senator from Delaware that followed Joe Biden in the Senate, and he actually authored one amendment to the Transition Act, and then another amendment he worked on, and it was named after him. So he was a transition expert. Jeff Zients, who's now the COVID coordinator, he's a management expert and just executed with precision. And Johannes Abraham worked with them, and he also did a great job. One of the things they decided early was that they felt that the tasks associated with this transition were mammoth, because we had the economic crisis, the health crisis, and a political crisis. They didn't know at that point that we would also have a kind of racial reckoning, as you said in the intro. But they decided to go big and to go deep with very, very experienced people. And they built a team of about 400 staff and volunteers, and then around 600 officials that were agency review experts. They also had a very, very significant line of work, which they called unconventional threats, which was basically, a normal transition is difficult enough, but they anticipated a lot of the problems that were created by Trump being in office and the lack of Trump cooperation. The other thing they did very early is they studied previous transitions. And in previous transitions, there was always tension between the campaign and the transition teams. This happened in Carter, in Clinton, in many other transitions. And they said, we're going to solve that. So they had a totally integrated team between the transition and the campaign, where the campaign came first, it was most important, the transition was subsidiary to the interests of the campaign, and they worked very, very closely together, and that avoided a blow-up that you've seen and a lot of other campaigns with their transitions.
You said that they were really integrated. Talk to me a little bit about the major players in the Biden transition and what were their impacts when we think about especially how this transition played out.
So at the leadership level, it was Ted Kaufman, Jeff Zients, and Johannes Abraham. They had a very experienced team doing what's called agency review and also policy. They integrated that as well. And that was Avril Haines, who's now the Director of National Intelligence, Cecilia Munoz, Carlos Monje, Salman Ahmed, who's now at the State Department, and Andrew Mayock. And they basically built the largest agency review team ever, and they covered more agencies than any other agency review team. They also invested heavily in a personnel operation. We can talk about the data, but they produced more personnel announcements than any other transition in history. And the key people there were Susie George, Gautam Raghavan, Lisa Monaco did the Senate confirmed officials, and Kathy Russell came in, and now she's head of presidential personnel. They've done a fantastic job. And really, it's probably the most productive transition in U.S. history from the Biden side.
You just named so many of the major players in the Biden transition. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the changes that they made compared to previous transitions. And also kind of tell me a little bit about the necessary pivots that they had to make as we think about how this transition unfolded.
Well, a first pivot was made in April when we had a call with Ted Kaufman and a bunch of other senior people with the GSA, actually Chris Liddell was on the line for a little. And we were talking about a remote transition. And someone asked Mary Jabert, who was the head of the GSA transition planning effort, a career official, what's your plan B in terms of having a remote transition? And she said, actually, that's not plan B, that's plan A. And so from that moment on, basically everybody planned for a remote transition. I think that they also really anticipated a lot of the problems that would be created with basically the Trump factor. And they also anticipated that the country would be in a crisis on election day. And so they needed to raise more money, hire more staff, have more senior people, because the challenges were greater than any other president in history on day one, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln. So they said, we're going to invest heavily because this president needs to be ready on day one. There's no time to waste.
On the podcast a few weeks ago, Biden co-chair Ted Kaufman described a stream of work he called unconventional threats, essentially a code word for the potential for non-cooperation by President Trump. The level of non-cooperation by the Trump White House was unprecedented. We saw the president say that the election was a fraud, refused to concede. Did the Biden team anticipate these problems, and how could they mitigate them? How do you work against a president who's refusing to concede? And of course, he also held up the official transition from happening.
So I think that they anticipated almost everything. The one thing they didn't anticipate, which no one could anticipate, was what happened on January 6th. It was so terrible that I don't think anybody could have contemplated that this would happen in our country in 2021. What they did anticipate was a delay in the outcome of the election because so many people would vote remotely or by mail. They anticipated a decent likelihood of a delayed ascertainment. They anticipated the impact of an uncooperative president and parts of the administration. They anticipated a lack of cooperation from certain agencies, and they built a whole plan to basically do the work they needed to do, even if they didn't get access to the agencies. And they also anticipated a slow Senate process. So I do think that they anticipated them. And then for each of these risks or potential challenges, they built a mitigation strategy. And unfortunately, for a lot of them, they had to implement those mitigation strategies. And again, nobody could have imagined what happened on January 6th in this country. It was one of the worst days of my life, I'm sure your life, and really one of the worst days in American history.
And I want to get to talking about January 6th, but in some ways, it's almost like the lead up to January 6th that is also really fascinating, especially given the work that you were doing. The GSA administrator, Emily Murphy, someone whose name the nation got to know because those weeks of pause where we didn't know if an official transition was going to happen. She refuses to ascertain the outcome, stalling the transition. Tell me a little bit about why she did that. And did you, the Biden team, the Trump White House, was that anticipated? And I'm also wondering, how much did you see Emily Murphy having a choice here? Was she more kind of just, it was more a bureaucratic thing, or did she really have choice? Did she really have free will in all this?
So the Biden team did anticipate the decent likelihood of a delay. We started talking to the Biden team about ascertainment, what it meant, what the legal standard was, what could happen late June, early July. So, you know, full 3 months before the election. Nobody even knew the word ascertainment before we started talking. I mean, so I think that she was in an impossible situation. You know, she's I don't think she's a really political person. She's basically a procurement expert who worked on Capitol Hill, came to the GSA as a procurement person, then was elevated to the head of GSA. And suddenly she wakes up and she finds herself in the middle of a presidential storm. And so when you're, you know, the head of a small agency and you have the president of the United States, the weight of the presidency weighing down on you, what do you do? How do you get out of that? The people at GSA told me that she had over 1 million emails and phone calls. She had death threats, but she also had a responsibility under the statute to make the right decision. So the legal standard is whether there's an apparent winner. And by the Saturday after the election, there was an apparent winner. All the networks had called it. George W. Bush had said there's a clear winner. Governors and senators had come out. And so at that point, she should have moved, in my view. By the time she made the decision on November 23rd, 3 weeks later, I think the weight of public opinion was really strongly in favor of her doing that. You had key Republican senators and governors like Senator Portman, Senator Toomey, Senator Moore Capito, Governors Mike DeWine and Hutchinson. These are governors and senators from big Trump states, Arkansas and Ohio, which Trump did very well in, basically saying it's time to get the transition going. And I think that the main concern was the lack of access to intelligence briefings and also the lack of access to Operation Warp Speed about the vaccine. And we're seeing the impact of that today.
I hear you talking about Emily Murphy. I wonder if I could ask you a follow-up on that, which is, do you feel like if she had moved earlier that it would have actually happened? Or how much sway does the president telling agencies, no, don't interact with the transition? I wonder, like, if she would have acted, are you convinced that even if the president was still saying, no, 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 don't do this, that the agency heads and everyone else would have gone on?
So it's a really good question. I don't know. I know that the vast majority of people across the agencies, political people and all the career people would have cooperated. We were getting calls from senior Trump officials all across the government saying, I want to cooperate with the Biden team. It's the right thing to do. It's the law. And they need access to information. You know, I'll give you a perfect example. There are small businesses all across the country that are basically being kept afloat by the Small Business Administration PPP loans, restaurants and travel agencies and nail salons. You know, these are mom and pop businesses and the livelihood of millions of Americans. And the fact that the Biden team couldn't get access to the SBA to figure out what was going on, how the program was working, how do we accelerate support for small businesses, it had a real impact on average Americans. And I think that pressure built. So I do think that if she had moved earlier, the vast majority of people would have cooperated, and then you would have had a small group of people that wouldn't have.
Partnership was also deeply engaged in shaping the ascertainment debate. And I guess I want to know, how did that impact, do you think, the outcome? Who had the most significant impact in that debate? I'm really struck by the calls that you were taking, hearing from people firsthand. Tell me a little bit about how this all came together.
What happened is that we were ready. We anticipated that there was a decent chance that there would be a delayed ascertainment. And so we're an effective government organization. We want government to be effective, and that means a smooth transition of power. So what we did is we marshaled all our arguments, and then we marshaled our network to support and create advocacy for a quick ascertainment. The Sunday after the networks called the election, President Bush put out a statement basically saying that the outcome of this election is clear. That same day, our advisory board, which is Mike Leavitt, former governor of Utah, Josh Bolton, Penny Pritzker, Mac McClarty, you know, eminent Americans on a bipartisan basis, they put out a statement, and we were debating that statement. I remember Mike added a sentence which said that the outcome is sufficiently clear that the transition should begin now. And that sentence was picked up in hundreds of newspapers all across the country. The New York Times used it in their editorial. And that started the debate and the pressure. And I think there were two strands of arguments that really had an impact. One is the national security argument that our national security is at stake if there's a lack of cooperation. And second is we were so close to having the vaccine ready that the distribution plans, how do you get the vaccine in 300 million Americans' arms, was such a national imperative that people on the Hill and people across the country said there has to be cooperation. And then President-elect Biden, I think, had a huge impact on the debate. I think it was around November 12th or 13th, he was asked, what's the impact of the delay? And without flinching, he said, more people may die. That's a heavy weight to say that more people will die on an executive branch official that is holding up the ascertainment. And so all of this effort built and built and built and created pressure for the GSA to do the right thing.
Obviously, Emily Murphy, she launched the formal part of the transition on November 23rd, covering the Biden administration already. I'm hearing from folks who are talking about the fact that they're shocked by how little of a vaccine distribution plan the Trump administration had. But I'm wondering, apart from there is obviously the vaccine distribution plan that was impacted, but what else was affected by the Biden team's preparedness? What else does it mean that this transition got underway 3 weeks later?
So most agencies kicked into high gear once ascertainment was made. They wanted to work with the Biden team. They wanted to do what was right for the country. They wanted to implement the law. And so there was good cooperation across many, many agencies. The Treasury Department was, you know, I think very, very cooperative. Other key economic agencies were very, very cooperative. Certain agencies, DOD, USTR, the Office of Management and Budget, they simply just didn't want to help. And they either slowed or never did much at all. You know, I think that with those agencies, there was real damage done. I think that that damage was ameliorated by the fact that President-elect Biden, you know, had so much experience and his team had so much experience. They were deep. They had been in these agencies and they planned for it. History will tell and we won't know for months. I do think you're seeing the impact in the distribution plans of the vaccine, which is probably the most important issue facing the country. So time will tell, but, you know, it's still really, really unfortunate that there was a delay and I think it hurt the country.
You're talking about the transition hurting the country in terms of and that delay hurting the country. The thing that I think about, and then maybe the thing that we all knew was a possibility, was that there was real physical manifestations of the views behind why the transition was delayed. President Trump was falsely saying that he won the election and that the election was rigged. Of course, that was not true. And the president on January 6th has this big rally nearby the White House, tells his supporters, we need to fight on, let's march to the Capitol. President Trump goes back to the White House where I'm covering it, and we're in a bubble of safety. But this mob of Trump supporters wearing his name, his logos, they break into the Capitol. Five people are killed. How did that impact the transition? How does that impact how things are going, where things are going to go? We see now multiple investigations into what happened on January 6th. It's one of the worst days in American history now. Tell me about how the siege on the Capitol impacts all this and impacts your work.
I think that Johannes Abraham on the podcast a few weeks ago, you know, said that every day in a transition is precious. There's only 78 days. Because of the delayed ascertainment, the Biden team only had 57 days. And essentially because of the entire episode on the Capitol, not just on the day of January 6th, but also leading up to it and after, they lost another week or 10 days. So that brings the transition down to 45-ish days, which is about the same as Bush had. He had 35 days because of the delayed Florida outcome. And so, you know, I think there was the shock and horror factor, which really ultimately is the most important, just because of what happened is just so bad. You know, a police officer was killed. The entire Congress was rushed out, hiding under the desks. It's just unimaginable. But on a more pragmatic basis, you know, it further slowed the Senate process, which was already slow because of the Georgia election. It impeded the Biden team's ability to get people confirmed. Most cabinet officers have confirmation hearings prior to the inauguration. I think something like 95% of the cabinet officers of initial president's term have benefited from pre-inaugural confirmation hearings. And I think Biden had 5 or 6. And so you're seeing now the slow pace of confirmation. So I think it did have a negative impact on the transition. It shocked the nation. And I think we're seeing the impact of it today. So hopefully the Senate can move quickly to get Biden's nominees confirmed. But I do think we're seeing the repercussions of that today in terms of the slow building of the government at a time when the American people need the government to be more effective than ever.
A week after the insurrection at the Capitol, that was a Wednesday, the next Wednesday, President Trump is impeached for a second time, becoming the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice. He also refused to attend the inauguration the next Wednesday, becoming the fourth president in U.S. history to refuse to attend that sacred event. First president since 1869 not to go to that event and officially hand off the reins to his successor. What impact do you think President Trump's refusal on the event, what impact do you think it had on society, on the transition, on this nation, as we all kind of think through our democracy and the state of it?
So originally, prior to January 6th, I thought he should go. It's a tradition, you know, not since Andrew Johnson and before that, the two Adams, neither of them went to their successor's inauguration. So I really thought it was important for the nation to see that symbolism. After January 6th, I think President-elect Biden said it right, that it was just better that he not go. I was happy that Vice President Pence went. I think that was an important symbolic handover. I thought the graciousness between his family and Vice President Harris's family was really, really poignant. And the fact that Vice President Harris walked him to the car, that's what American history is all about, that you can have warring opponents during an election, but after the election, we respect our democracy. That's what President Obama did for President Trump, even though they were bitter opponents. And so, you know, I mean, it saddens me. I actually went up to the Capitol today to meet a friend. We went for a social distance walk, and I saw the troops up there and the barbed wire. It's still around the Capitol. The Capitol is still under siege. And honestly, it saddens me what's going on in our country.
It is really, really sad times when I think about all that we've witnessed and all that we did witness that day and kind of the vibrations and consequences that continue. I want to, in some ways, look forward now that Biden was inaugurated 2 weeks after that attack on the Capitol. How has the Biden team done with respect to personnel compared to previous transitions? Yes, it's true, as you said, that he has less confirmed members of his cabinet than other presidents, but I'm wondering if you're interested, if you could talk a little bit more about other appointees, other nominees.
So they've built a machine, a personnel machine. They get enormous credit. There are three buckets of personnel to look at. One is the White House, Ron Klain, the White House Chief of Staff. He started early and he moved fast. He appointed more than twice as many officials to the White House staff than any other previous president at this point in time. So I think he announced 230, 240 White House staff by the time of the inauguration. That's unprecedented and really, really impressive. The Senate confirmed officials, there are 1,250. The Biden team announced 52. Actually, President-elect Biden nominated 52. The previous record was 42 by President Obama, so they're way ahead on that. And then the other thing, you know, this gets to something that Ted Kaufman and others really envisioned, which is they envisioned that the Senate would be slow. And there's a whole group of non-confirmed officials all across the government. And they had 1,100 of those officials sworn in on Inauguration Day. That's blows away the record. It's more than Obama and Trump had combined at day 100. So they've really, their personnel team has been fantastic and highly, highly productive. They also built this incredible machine to conduct interviews. And they conducted something like 8,000 interviews during the transition to place those 1,100 people. And so it's really impressive what they've done. And it's the reason they did it is because they felt the issues facing the country were so significant that you had to flood the zone and get as many people into the government as possible to deliver for the American people. So I'm happy they did that.
So if you're talking, you just say that they flooded the zone, they had all these interviews, had kind of built this machine. When you go back to look at how this transition has gone compared to previous transitions, where does it rank? How would you compare it to others?
You know, one of the things about hosting this podcast, and I'm sure it's one of the things you love about your job, is you get to talk to amazing people and ask them questions and learn. And so, you know, I was able to talk to Ken Burns, the historian, to a fellow named Ted Widmer, who is an expert on the Lincoln presidency, Eric Rauchway, who's an expert on the Hoover to Roosevelt transition. And we've actually had some email exchanges. You can't say this is worse than 1860. Seven states seceded, we had a civil war. So 1932, it was a four-month transition. The Great Depression peaked. We had bank runs in 25 states. Hitler came to power and Hoover did nothing. Both Roosevelt and Merrill Eccles, who was the head of the Federal Reserve, begged Hoover to basically call a bank holiday to stop the banks from running and stop people from losing their homes and their savings, and Hoover refused. That was a pretty bad transition. But as Ken Burns said in the clip when we opened, no shots have been fired, nobody's been killed, no arms have been raised in any transition previous. So I would say that this one has to be somewhere between 1860 and 1932. Again, ameliorated by the fact that the Biden team was so experienced and so buttoned up, it was a bad transition this year.
It was a bad transition is the understatement of the century. But yes,
I have a nonpartisan good government hat on, so I have to be balanced.
Yeah. No, I mean it's the same thing with press. It was challenging, is the way we would put it, on the NewsHour. That being said, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what changes to the law need to be made based on the problems with this transition. Do you see things that should be changed?
So I think there are a few things the Congress really should look at. I think the issue of ascertainment, there has to be a lower standard for starting the process. We could have close elections again. Actually, this was not really a close election. We could have contested elections again. But the president-elect, the challenger, needs access to the services and support of the GSA and the government earlier. I think that the challenger should get more money for staffing, and everything should be moved up earlier. So after 9/11, because of the delay in the Bush transition, Bush didn't have all his people in place on 9/11, and the 9/11 Commission found that that hurt our country. So Congress passed an amendment to the Presidential Transition Act and the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act that accelerated a lot of the activities like security clearances and access to GSA services and funds. I think that the whole transition should move earlier because 78 days is really not enough to get started on January 20th. I'm confident that Congress will look at that and they should improve the laws.
And you also worked really closely with the press throughout the transition. You came on the NewsHour a couple times to explain to the country how transitions work and what was going on. What did you think of the press coverage throughout the cycle?
Well, we're big fans of the NewsHour. Actually, my wife and I on Friday night, we ordered in dinner and we sat on the couch and watched you and Judy Woodruff. And Pam remarked to me how romantic it was that was our Friday night date, watching the NewsHour. I think overall, the press did a good job. They took this transition very seriously. Obviously, there was intensity of interest around this transition like no other. I found most press very, very good to deal with. I think that the ascertainment delay, The amount of interest among the press was just intense because they were trying to figure out what it means, what is the word ascertainment, what does the Transition Act require, and what are the implications. The one negative thing about the press, I'd say, is the pressure to speculate over who's going to be in the cabinet is so immense that you just see these names thrown out there that really the likelihood of them getting jobs is pretty low. So in the 2016 cycle, the Center for Presidential Transition did an analysis of one publication, I won't name which one, who had a definitive article on who was going to get cabinet picks, you know, 3 or 4 days after the election. And they got something like 3 out of 15 right. And this year we saw the same thing. So I always joked with people on the transition that the best thing you can do to get a job is not be one of the people that the press names, because the likelihood that you'll get that job is pretty low. So overall, I think it was very, very positive. I think that the pressure to speculate over who's going to get jobs is very hard. But let me ask you a question, Yamiche. Let me turn the tables here. So what is it going to be like covering the Biden White House versus the Trump White House? And one of the reasons I became a fan of yours was I remember there was a White House Rose Garden press conference where the president really went after you personally. And I thought that you handled that moment with skill and grace, where his comments were borderline, I'll be circumspect here, but they were problematic, let's say it. So how did you hold it together at that moment? And what's it going to be like covering the Biden White House versus the Trump White House?
I think, thanks for the question. I will let you turn the table since you are the regular host of this podcast. I think covering the Trump White House was challenging, but I think in some ways the Trump years put the mission of journalism in perfect focus. We really are people that are representative of the country. We really are people who are asking questions on behalf of Americans who may not ever make it into the White House, who are sitting around their kitchen tables, maybe even eating Friday night dinners, watching a news hour at a date night like you and your wife. I think that for me, when the president was targeting me or when things got challenging to try to get information, I kept thinking there are so many Americans whose lives are at risk in the middle of a pandemic who really need this information. They need to know when are they going to be able to get tests? They need to know, why are we so behind? They need to know, when's the vaccine coming? That for me, the lesson of the Trump years is to really just be focused on delivering good, fair, accurate journalism, and also trying to break it down in simple terms so that people know what to expect going forward. So I think when I think about covering the Biden administration, I think of the same thing. We're going to be asking tough questions. We're going to be holding the Biden White House accountable. Of course, holding President Trump accountable was at times about fact-checking him a lot. And I'm not sure if we're going to have to do that in the same way as with the Biden White House, but we'll be ready if that's what we have to do. So I think in some ways, President Trump was just a reminder of just what is at stake and why the press and the president and Congress, they're all in the Constitution. Our founders realized that there was going to be some tension there, and they wanted us all to be inscribed in the founding documents of our country.
And did you ever imagine when you started off in journalism that there would be a moment where there was a nationally covered news conference where the president of the United States would personally go after you?
Never. I'm from Miami, Florida, and my dream job was to be a cops reporter for the Miami Herald. That was my dream job. That was what I wanted to spend my life doing. Sadly, I could not get a job at the Miami Herald when I graduated from Georgetown in the middle of the financial crisis. And as a result, I ended up kind of going on a different trajectory, and it led me to the White House. So I'm grateful that I had to kind of go through some challenges in the first years of my career. But I'm so grateful for the fact that I could be doing this work at the White House. My parents, having come here from Haiti in the 1970s, would never have ever imagined that their daughter would be questioning the president of the United States. I think my family is still in some ways in awe of the fact that I get to go to the White House every day to ask questions and to be part of this democracy that they risk their lives being a part of and getting to. So I think it's a real honor. And I think that's part of the reason why I was so grounded, I feel like, when the president was going after me or doing things, because I really felt like this is where I needed to be in this moment.
Well, I know that there's not a lot of Jewish people from Haiti, but I'm Jewish, and there's a prayer for strong and great women in the Jewish tradition where they call the woman a woman of valor. And I think you're a woman of valor, Yamiche, and I think you do a wonderful job.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that. And I think if I could, I would say that you're a man of valor. I think there were so many times when our country was confused and scared, and you being on the news hour to explain to people about how this is supposed to work, and you talking to transition officials and you doing this work, it was so critical. Transitions had never been this scary before. And there were so many people who I know were really settled by the information that you were giving on the news hour and settled by the information that you were sharing even today, that you give us so much perspective as a country that you are absolutely a treasure. And I think reminding people there was a transition where 7 states seceded from the United States were not at civil war. It's good perspective because these are such scary times, but we have to remind ourselves that we're a country that has continued to go forward despite the struggles and even a civil war. So I think you're so valuable. It's so great to be able to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for your time and thanks for doing this.
So folks, thank you very much for listening. I want to give a little personal message because this is going to be my last podcast. We're taping this on January 25th, 5 days after Inauguration Day. The Biden-Harris transition team is now the Biden-Harris administration. And in the last 12 months, when you've been listening to Transition Lab, a lot's happened. Health crises, a global pandemic, an economics crisis, a political crisis, a racial justice crisis, and an unprecedented attack on our democracy. Through all of this, our democratic process survived. An election occurred, and a presidential transition, a peaceful transfer of power, followed thereafter. The White House, the Biden transition team, and the federal agencies navigated just unbelievable obstacles. The pandemic, the delayed GSA ascertainment, and the insurrection at the Capitol. Now the difficult task of governing begins. And that's the entire process. That's the entire focus of a transition, to be ready to govern on day one, which Joe Biden was ready. As the presidential cycle has now come to a close, so will Transition Lab, at least the first season. Over this year, we've covered every modern transition from Carter to Trump. We've covered old transitions like Lincoln and Roosevelt, and we've covered specific issues like personnel and vetting. Here's a few numbers. 48 episodes, 62 guests, 25 hours of podcasts, all on the subject of presidential transition. Who would have thought? We've had some wonderful guests, White House chiefs of staff, wonderful historians, journalists and filmmakers like Ken Burns, and transition experts from past administrations. I want to thank a few people, the guests who have done a wonderful job storytelling and educating all of us on the importance of presidential transitions. I want to thank you, the tens and tens of thousands of listeners who have tuned in along the way. I especially want to thank those who have worked on Transition Lab over the last year plus. They were extraordinary. Alex Tippett, he's been my right-hand person throughout the 48 episodes. He helped research, identify guests, write questions, and helped me throughout the process, day and night, until he left recently for a new great job, for which I'm very excited for Alex. Bob Cohen and Barry Goldberg helped with the writing and marketing and did wonderful work. Carter Hirschhorn has played an instrumental role, and not only when Alex was here, but then filling in for Alex when he left for his new job. Emma Jones, Austin Laufisweiler, Catherine Roloff, and Amelia Ziegler were responsible for marketing and promotion. They did a great job. Meredith Huddle and Alex Kelke, they were our social media gurus, promoting the podcast on Twitter and other social media. They did a fantastic job, and I think they had fun. We had some phenomenal center interns, Isabella Epstein and Jack Simmons. They did some great work on a bunch of the podcasts. Katie Bryan and Paul Hitlin, they helped turn this idea into reality. And actually, Paul and his brother came up with the name Transition Lab, which was hard to come up with. Paul Woody Woodhull and McKenna Chester were our studio gurus. They handle the lab. They work with District Productive. They help deal with all of my imperfections, my stumbles, my retapes. And Paul has become a really good friend. Anybody that wants to do podcasts should meet Paul Woody Woodhull. And then what's happening next? Transition Lab may be wrapping up, but the partnership will be producing a brand new podcast this spring. It's going to focus on leadership in public service, and it will focus on effective government leaders and what makes them successful. It'll also focus on how their decisions impact the public. So please continue to follow the Center for Presidential Transition as it moves to its next chapter of work, evaluating this transition, figuring out what can be done better, and tracking and supporting effectiveness in government on a bipartisan basis, both in the new administration and with the Congress. Thanks for listening. If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.